Okay, well, we are continuing our sermon series we've been going through called Thrones. We have been journeying through the Bible. If you have been with us for the last year and a half, journeying through the Bible narrative, and we found ourselves for a few months now in this era that we're calling Thrones. And the deal with Thrones is it's the study of Israel's kingdom in the Old Testament times, the Israel's kingdom. After the death of King Solomon, the kingdom divided into two, the north and the south. A couple weeks ago, we saw the northern kingdom come to an end. They were conquered. They were done for. There is no more northern kingdom right now. There's only what we call the land of Samaria. But the southern kingdom is still intact for now. And we're going to continue a couple more weeks. We're almost done with this little mini-series of the scriptures here. But right now, we saw 2 weeks ago that in the south, a new king arose whose name was Hezekiah. Hezekiah was a reformer. He took the mess his father left behind and fixed it. Hezekiah's dad's name was Ahaz, and he was a terrible leader. He made a mess of the kingdom, worshiping, just running down some dark paths, some very vulgar practices that were murderous and gross. He rejected God. He actually closed the doors of the temple and shuttered them so that no one could use it anymore, which was the first time that had ever been done in the history of the temple or the tabernacle before it, to be shut down from the people. He did that. He just ran from God, and he weakened the kingdom through his addictive and bad habits. He just lost the narrative, and Israel struggled because of him. But when he died, and no one was sorry when he died, he was a terrible leader. When he died, his son Hezekiah took over, and Hezekiah was a reformer. He reopened the temple that his father shut down. He rebuilt the furniture that was torn apart. He reestablished faith in the nation on an official level. On top of that, he reintroduced the Psalms, which is the music of King David that was anciently written by David when he was king. He brought it back to the front. He wrote some Psalms of his own and added to it. He had other musicians involved. He also collected the Proverbs, or the wisdom literature of Solomon, and actually added some more of Solomon's Proverbs to the official canon, and wrote some other people's Proverbs in there as well, and expanded the wisdom literature. And that's important to us. You know why? Because in our Bibles today, our Old Testament today, those Psalms and Proverbs echo on, and Hezekiah did a lot to rebolster the use of those during his leadership. He was in trouble because the people who wiped out the northern kingdom were pressing down on him, and no one could stop them. But he went to the temple, he bowed in his face before God and prayed, and God intervened and gave him a miracle. And the Assyrians were returned back home because of another crisis, and the king of Assyria was killed by his own sons back at home, and the nation went into some kind of chaos. And all of this happened during Hezekiah's reign. He was a great king. Today, we're going to continue the rest of his story, and we're going to look at the story of his son Manasseh after him. And then we're going to make a couple applications and go home. But let's finish Hezekiah. He's having a remarkable reign. Let's continue in 2 Kings chapter 20, and beginning with verse 1. About that time, Hezekiah became deathly ill, and the prophet Isaiah, son of Amoz, went to visit him. He gave the king this message: this is what the Lord says, set your affairs in order, for you are going to die. You will not recover from this illness. What a shocking development for Hezekiah. He's doing great. They just watched, he's been a good leader. They just watched God take the Assyrian army off their backs and send them home. They're doing really well. They just averted death. They just averted tragedy. Everything is up and to the right, and all of a sudden, things change. In a New York minute, right? Everything can change. And all of a sudden, he developed a boil that broke out on his skin, and it kept spreading, and nothing was working, and it was making him weak and bedridden. And if the doctor comes to you and says it's terminal, that's bad news. In this case, it was the prophet Isaiah, which is even worse because he was like this spiritual clairvoyant from God, saying, God says you're going to die, so get your trust and will in order because it's over, Rover. And Hezekiah is shocked to hear that just at the peak of his young kingdom, 15 years into his reign, he's about to die. In verse 2, it says, when Hezekiah heard this, he turned his face to the wall and he prayed to the Lord. Hezekiah was always known to pray. Last time, he went to the temple and prayed before the Lord in the temple when the enemy nation was attacking them. But now he's too ill to get out of bed, so he prays where he's at by facing the wall. But here's the point. It doesn't matter in what posture you pray or in what place you pray. It's the person we're praying to. It's God who we're talking to, and he hears your prayer wherever you are. And so Hezekiah prays from his own bed of illness. Here's what he says in verse 3. Remember, O Lord, how I have always been faithful to you, and I have served you single-mindedly, always doing what pleases you. Then he broke down, and he wept bitterly. Can you imagine? I mean, what a shocking set of news to be given. Like, God, I thought I was doing well. I thought we just turned a corner as a nation. Things are going well. God, why now? And he's weeping bitterly. He's breaking down. Verse 4. But before Isaiah, the prophet, had left the middle courtyard, this message came to him from the Lord. Go back to Hezekiah, the leader of my people. Tell him, this is what the Lord, the God of your ancestor David, says. I have heard your prayer and seen your tears. I will heal you. And 3 days from now, you will get out of bed and go to the temple of the Lord. That's a beautiful passage, and it brings some mixed emotions out of me as I read it, maybe out of you. On the positive side, how cool to see God answer prayer. But at the same time, I look at that and I'm thinking, how many times have I known someone that I've prayed for, that you've prayed for, that we've cared about, for God to heal them, and they didn't get that answer. They didn't get that experience. I would have liked that. And it's just something to sort through. And because I've seen God answer prayers, that I've seen God choose not to or have a different plan. And it's so hard to have that mindset that says, I have to remember, like we said last Sunday, that his ways are higher than our ways. His thoughts are higher than our thoughts. But man, I don't understand why he didn't answer that one. But he does hear, and he does sometimes. And regardless of where you've experienced the answer to prayer you were looking for or not, I think one comforting thought is the thought we put in bold up here. That God says, I have heard your prayer and I've seen your tears. That's helpful to me. Because yes, I would like to think that if God heard my prayer, he would do what I want him to do. I'd like to think that if God heard me, he would give me my wishes. That would be my ideal. I'd like to have that kind of a belief system where I say, God is what I want and God does it. But I do understand that his way is different than mine and his thoughts are higher. His will is sometimes beyond what I understand. But to be honest with you, if I'm not going to get what I want, I at least want to believe that God has heard my prayer and seen my tears. Because there's a comfort in knowing that even though he can but he doesn't, that he's aware. Like we said last week, that God says, I am aware and I care. I'm aware and I care. That helps. Because the worst thing to see is to go through a tough time and say, is there even a God at all, or is God unaware? Does God turn his back? Is he incapable of helping me, or does he not care about me? But the idea that even if I don't get what I want, but he's paying attention, and my prayer is heard, my tears are seen, that's a beautiful promise. And the Bible tells us elsewhere, Psalms of David wrote at one spot that God keeps all of our tears in a bottle and knows why each one of them is ever shed, that nothing you ever go through is lost on God's love. Anyhow, God does heal him, though. It says in verse 6, God says, I will add 15 years to your life, and I will rescue you and this city from the king of Assyria. I will defend the city for my honor and for the sake of my servant David. Let's be real, folks. Most of that verse, we already saw that 2 weeks ago. God's already answering the whole rescue you from Assyria. That's already in motion. He just says, I'm going to keep that going. But that first part, that's pretty big news. I'll add 15 years to your life. Hezekiah knows exactly how long he's going to live. Maybe not to the day or the week, but to pretty close to the year, 15 years from now. Is that good or bad? I mean, I wonder how many of us would like to know when our expiration date arrives, right? Like, is that a good thing or a bad thing? Right? Bad? You say bad, Kathy? I mean, I kind of think so. Some people might be like, oh, I want to know exactly when I'm going to die because then I can plan my life around that and do all these things. Others are like, man, that will just be like a dark cloud hanging over my head. I'd rather not even know. I didn't ask this last hour. Show of hands. How many would like to know exactly when you're going to die? You'd like to know. You're in that group? Okay. Got a handful. How many of you would like to not know? You'd rather not know. Okay. Most hands. Some of you raise your hands neither time. There's only two answers to that question, folks, okay? die? But here's the thing. Some of us would like to know, some would not like to know. Would Hezekiah like to know or not like to know? I don't know. Either way, I know this. 15 years is better than zero. And that's where he was at before God stepped in. And it was a turnaround. In verse 7, then Isaiah, the prophet, said, hey, make an ointment from figs. So Hezekiah's servants spread the ointment over the boil, and Hezekiah recovered. Interesting side note that Hezekiah did not only have prayer, but he also followed medical advice, right? He trusted in both spiritual and medical practices in getting himself recovered here. And he was recovered. And I would love to tell you folks today that Hezekiah's life continues to be awesome, because he has been an awesome king so far. But I got bad news for you. He kind of turns here. And I don't know what changes. I don't know if it was the confidence that he has 15 years and nothing's going to stop him now. He's rich. He's going to live longer. And his enemy nation's gone. I don't know if it was that. He got complacent or unhealthy. But something seems to change in Hezekiah at the end. And it happens too many times to people. They're on a good track and then something derails him. Let's read about that together. 2 Kings 20, verse 12. Soon after this, Merodach-Baladan, son of Baladan, king of Babylon, sent Hezekiah his best wishes and a gift, for he heard that Hezekiah had been very sick. I need to take a couple minutes here and talk about the setting, because it's going to be important for what happens the next few weeks. Babylon is a powerful city, a famous city, that's been around, they've been around 1,500 years earlier than this. They've been around for a while. And in ancient times, through the history that we know, they were ebbing and flowing, stronger and weaker. They've been a city and a kingdom around them that had their ups and downs. During this particular time period, while the Assyrian Empire was at its peak, they actually, for a while, controlled Babylon. I don't know if they conquered them like they did other cities, or if they just kind of intimidated them into paying some dues. But they had some control over Babylon. But we saw 2 weeks ago that Assyria's king was killed by his own sons, and they're going to be starting a season of decline. And during this time, Babylon's going to break free in the near future from Assyria's control. And as Assyria begins to fade, Babylon's going to snatch up all the power left in the vacuum. And Babylon will become, over the next few decades, the next world power. And that's important to our history that we're going to get to later. But right now, they're still not there. And the king of Babylon hears through his ambassadors or through spies or whatever that Hezekiah was ill, and then he recovered. So he sends a gift, like a good world leader trying to get close to another world leader and make a connection point. And it's smart, right? Even if in a world of war where you're trying to conquer the other team and beat other nations, when you're not strong enough to do that yet, you play nice. Because you don't want enemies all around you. So you're civil. You have ambassadors and diplomacy until you're ready to go to war because you think you're strong enough. And so he's building a bridge and says, hey, Hezekiah, I heard you were sick. Here's my men. Here's a gift. Congratulations on your recovery. Verse 13. When Hezekiah received the Babylonian envoys, and he showed them everything in his treasure houses, the silver, the gold, the spices, the aromatic oils. He also took them to see his armory and showed them everything in his royal treasuries. There was nothing in his palace or kingdom that Hezekiah did not show them. Why? Why would you take another nation coming your way and open up the gates and show them? Like, hey guys, yeah, I'm healed and we beat the Assyrians left and we're also rich. Come check out my vaults of money. Like, why would you do that? That's like just like dangling, like that's like going online to social media and telling everybody that you're rich and giving them your bank account number to check it out for themselves. I mean, he just shows off to this other nation of ambassadors who are going to report back home, look at all our wealth, all the spots we keep it hidden. I want you to see how rich I am. He's bragging. Is he proud? Is he arrogant? Is he just stupid? I don't know. But he shows everything to them. Then they leave. They're like, huh, thanks. Have a nice day. Enjoy the toaster, you know, whatever they brought him. And they went home. Verse 14, then Isaiah the prophet went to King Hezekiah and asked him, what did those men want? Where were they from? Now, I think Hezekiah, I think Isaiah knew the answer because he was that spiritual, prophetic, vision-seeing guy. He probably knew who they were, right? He's doing what you moms and dads do when your kids did something and you're like, "What? Where were you and what did you do?" You know the answer. You just want to hear them say it, you know? So he's like, where were those men from? What did they do? And Hezekiah replied, "Oh, they came from the distant land of Babylon." "What did they see in your palace?" Isaiah asked. "They saw everything," Hezekiah replied. "I showed them everything I own, all my royal treasuries." And now Isaiah is about to go into spiritual vision mode, prophetic clairvoyant mode. And Isaiah said to Hezekiah, "Listen to this message from the Lord. The time is coming when everything in your palace, all the treasures stored up by your ancestors until now, will be carried off to Babylon. Nothing will be left," says the Lord. He says, here's a little news flash from the future. Babylon is the next big player. You don't see it now, but God's going to let you know now because you may as well know. They're the next big player. And the day is coming beyond your lifetime where they're going to march into this city and take all this loot away that's been here. And that's not the worst of it. He continues. Verse 18, "Some of your very own sons will be taken away into exile. They will become eunuchs who will serve in the palace of Babylon's king." Now, Hezekiah, just a little history for those who care about this. Hezekiah did not have children yet. He was old enough to have had a lot of kids. Most kings did. But for some reason, records show that he did not have children. And history teaches us, historical documents and records teach us that Hezekiah married, at some point here, he married Isaiah the prophet's daughter, Hephzibah, however you say it. Which, by the way, Hezekiah and Hephzibah, those are some great names right there. If you parents, young people are looking for names for your future kids, mark those ones down. There are possibilities for, your kids will love them later, trust me. But anyhow, this couple, Isaiah's daughter and Hezekiah, maybe when Hezekiah was leaning into God, leaning into prayer for deliverance, he got to know the prophet, and they got to know his daughter, and they thought, oh, she's fine. And then they got married. But they don't have kids. He has no kids that we know of yet, but what records show he has one later, and then maybe several. But when it says his sons will be taken away, it doesn't necessarily mean his sons. It could mean his descendants, his grandsons as well. Your future generation. Sometimes sons is used in the Bible back then to refer to just your future posterity. Okay? But some of your very own sons will be taken away into exile. They'll become eunuchs. Now, I won't discuss what that means to become a eunuch. We won't get into that right now. But let's just go to say they had a little procedure done, and they will no longer be a threat to the, they will be no threat to the maidens of Babylon. Okay? And so they are made eunuchs, and they're going to serve in the palace of Babylon's king. That's his future descendants. What would his reaction be? What would Hezekiah's reaction be to this news? Maybe his reaction could be, "Oh, I'm so sorry I showed those guys my treasures. I had no idea that they could be spying out my future wealth. That was a mistake, and I'm sorry," right? Or maybe his reaction could be, "Hey, I'm going to pray and ask God to change that story." Well, God said it's going to happen. But God also said Hezekiah was going to die. And he prayed, and God answered that prayer. God changed his mind there. Maybe I can pray, and God will change his mind for the sake of my children after me someday. Right? Those would seem like reasonable reactions by Hezekiah. But that's not what he says in verse 19. "Then Hezekiah said to Isaiah, 'This message you have given me from the Lord is good.'" Excuse me? It's good? I'm pretty sure that message was anything but good. Why would you say that? Here's why. "For the king was thinking, 'At least there will be peace and security during my lifetime.'" Wow. There it is. There's that side of ourselves that can show up that we hopefully don't have, or when it shows up, we bury it, but boy, he just owned it. See, well, I would never say something like that. Well, he didn't say it either. It says he thought it. How do we know what he thought? Because Isaiah the prophet was there. He wrote about it in his book of, you know, spiritual. He knows everything right now. So, hey, at least it'll be good for me. Here's the thing. It's human for us to be self-centered more than we want to admit we are. You know what's very human? Here's humanity for you. When thousands or tens of thousands of people are suffering somewhere in the world, but I got a raise, everything's great, life is good. And if several people in the world had a really big blessing come their way, but I had a setback, everything is terrible, life is bad. That's just human nature a little bit. And we have to fight that, hopefully. And when we see things pop up in our hearts that we are like, oh, I can't believe I thought that. I feel bad for thinking that. That's a chance to do a little heart scope with God and say, God, help me have a healthy heart. Hezekiah's heart was in a spot where he said, hey, yeah, my kids will have a bad time, but you know what? That's good, because I'll have peace. That's all that matters to me. When look at ourselves and ask ourselves, where do we care so much about our own welfare where we might not care about somebody else's, especially our own children? I've known people before who are like, well, my kids aren't respectful anyhow. They don't, you know, make me feel good, honor me the way they should, so they'll get what's coming to them. Like, really? Really? Is that healthy? How about we just sit there and say, God, I want your blessing, but I want your blessing on my posterity, on other people, especially those. I mean, folks, this ought to be one of those things where we say, God, is there any of that in me? Because I don't want it to get there. But Hezekiah was like, eh, that's some good news. Well, it's good because it'll happen when I'm dead and I get a good life until then. My kids, well, whatever. Ouch. Verse 20. The rest of the events in Hezekiah's reign, including the extent of his power and how he built a pool and dug a tunnel to bring water into the city, cool, are recorded in the book of the history of the kings of Judah. Hezekiah died, and his son Manasseh became the next king. Before we get to Manasseh, I want to just summarize Hezekiah one more way. He's been a remarkable king. I know the last story kind of stunk, but he had a pretty remarkable, he's a reformer. We're thankful for things we have in our Bibles today because of Hezekiah's careful preservation and enhancement. He was a very important person, and I don't want to discount his good life, but he had a really weird bonus 15 years, right? But you know, poor Manasseh, Manasseh grew up. Manasseh wasn't even born until those last 15 years. Manasseh becomes a 12-year-old king. The only version of King Hezekiah that Manasseh knew was the later year's dad that's like, as long as it's good for me, who cares? I mean, that's the way he grew up in. We'll get to him in a moment here. But Hezekiah had a pretty remarkable life, but I want to summarize him one other way. Because in the Bible, we have the books of 1 and 2 Kings and 1 and 2 Chronicles, and both are accounts of the same time period, though they tell some different stories that overlap. Well, we're going to go from Kings now to Chronicles, because in Chronicles, there's a summary of Hezekiah's story that we just read a little differently, and I want you to notice the wording there. So let's go to 2 Chronicles chapter 32, verse 24. About that time, Hezekiah became deathly ill. He prayed to the Lord, who healed him and gave him a miraculous sign. We did not discuss that sign, but it's another story for a different time. But that's the story we read earlier. But look at how Chronicles summarizes what happens next in verse 25. It says, but Hezekiah did not respond appropriately to the kindness shown him, and he became proud. And I love that summary. Pride is always at the base of almost every bad decision we make. Maybe the fact that he had lots of money, that the enemies had left him, that his health had turned around, and he guaranteed 15 years. Maybe he got complacent or self-sufficient and proud. But I think that first part of the verse might feed into it. Is it the chicken or the egg? Which comes first? I don't know. But it says he did not respond appropriately to the kindness shown him, and he became proud. And I think today, if I could just give you something, I know we're telling our story still, if I can just stop the story and ask you today, if you want to be the person that, your best self, a healthy person, a person that does God's will and lives the life God's called you to live and makes a difference and finishes your race the way you should and want to. But you know how easy it is to make a misstep and get off course. This could be a helpful thing for us to consider. And I want you to take this with you. How do we respond to the kindnesses that are shown to us? How do we respond? To kindnesses from anybody. To the kindnesses our spouse shows us, our children show us, our parents show us, our boss or our employees or our neighbors and friends, or God. shows us over and over again in life. When we get to the spot where we say, the things that the people do for me, I'm so grateful for, I appreciate kindness. It's a humble posture, it's a grateful posture. When we look at that and we take it for granted and say, oh no, I deserve that. That's how you should treat me as a spouse. That's how you should treat me as a parent or as a child or as a employer or employee or a friend. That's how God should bless my life. I'm entitled to be treated that way. And instead, I'm going to look at what I don't think is right and be upset. I'll take the good things that come my way and say, I deserve those, but this isn't good enough and that's not good enough and I'm upset about that. I'm upset at you. I'm upset at you. I'm upset at you, Lord, because I want more. And the kindnesses are my entitlement. That's a dangerous place to get in our life, isn't it? But it's so easy to accidentally get to a spot where we just think, well, of course I should get that. But you know what's not good enough? Can I just ask you today that we would not just be kind, but we'd be humble and grateful for the kindnesses that come our way from anybody. Like, wow, you didn't have to do that. You didn't have to be that way. I didn't have to have it this good. Many folks don't have it this good. Many folks don't have a spouse that treats them even that good, or parents or children that treat them that good, or a boss or an employee that work that well, or friends like that. I mean, yeah, you could be better. Sure, maybe. I could be better. But some people have so much worse. You're kind. God, I have blessings in my life from you that other people never have experienced. I've experienced them in my life. And I am not expecting that. I am grateful for it. I'm humble and I'm content. How we respond to the kindness that comes our way will probably have an impact on the health of our well-being and the direction and quality of our life. And Hezekiah did not respond appropriately to the kindness that was shown him. He became proud. Well, he died, and in his place, his 12-year-old son. Second Chronicles 33, verse 1, says, Manasseh was 12 years old when he became king. He reigned 55 years in Jerusalem. That's a long reign. But when you start at age 12, you have more time, right? I mean, let's be honest. When you start at age 12, 55 years means you're only 67 when you're done. And that'd be very young considering presidential candidates and most congressmen we have in America today. But that's another story for another time. But here's the thing, 12-year-old boy, he's going to reign for 55 years, but he, unfortunately, verse 2, he did what was evil in the Lord's sight. Following the detestable practices of the pagan nations, the Lord had driven from the land ahead of the Israelites. He goes on a path away from his father's reforms, back to his grandfather's actions. Why? Hezekiah brought him so far back, but maybe because he didn't like his father. I mean, we just read his father. He was born during his father's proud, selfish years. Maybe he didn't. He's like, oh, jerk. I don't know who wants his faith, you know? I don't know what happened, but Manasseh's like, that ain't for me, man. And he goes on a whole different path. It says in verse number 3 that he rebuilt the pagan shrines his father Hezekiah had broken down. He constructed altars for the images of Baal and set up Asherah poles. We will not rediscuss Baal worship and Asherah worship. We've done it before. It's pretty vulgar, and we've been down that road in months past. But he goes back to that stuff. He also bowed down before all the powers of the heavens and worshiped them. He built pagan altars in the temple of the Lord, the place where the Lord said, my name will remain in Jerusalem forever. Did you catch that? Let me keep reading and I'll explain. He built pagan altars, verse 5, he built these altars for all the powers of the heavens in both courtyards of the Lord's temple. His grandfather had done something terrible when he shut the doors of the temple so no one could worship there. He's like, it's closed down for business, which was an unprecedented move in the history of Israel. But Hezekiah reopened it and reestablished it. Now he does something very different. He doesn't close it down, he just repurposes it. He guts it out and says, we're going to worship these pagan idols and other things and do other stuff with the Lord's temple. Inside the temple, folks. That's pretty messed up right there. Manasseh also sacrificed his own sons in the fire in the valley of Ben-Hinnom. Not the first time we've seen this. What would make a person's religious beliefs cause them to offer child sacrifice, their own children in the fire? That's crap. That's messed up. That's concerning. He takes his sons and he burns them in the fire as a child sacrifice. What kind of religion is that? You got a religion that asks you to do that kind of stuff? Get out. By the way, God will never ask. He gave his son for you and me, for our salvation. That's another story. But he's doing this vulgar stuff. It says this in verse number 6 still. He practiced sorcery, divination, witchcraft, and consulted with mediums and psychics. And he did much that was evil in the Lord's sight, arousing his anger. Manasseh even took a carved idol he had made and set it up in God's temple, the very place where God had told David and his son Solomon, my name will be honored forever in this temple in Jerusalem, the city I've chosen from among all the tribes of Israel. And God said, if the Israelites will be careful to obey my commands, all the laws, decrees, and regulations given through Moses, I will not send them into exile from this land I've set aside for your ancestors. In other words, if you'll just follow, trust me, I've taken you from slavery, I've brought you here. If you'll follow my best practices, you'll thrive, but if you don't, it will weaken you. But Manasseh led the people of Judah and Jerusalem to do even more evil than the pagan nations the Lord had destroyed when the people of Israel had entered the land. Now, you think that God is just like, fine, ping, you're done, right? But that's not how God works. In verse 10, it says, the Lord spoke to Manasseh and his people, but they ignored all his warnings. God tried over and over again to reach them and say, hey, this is not the way to live. These are not best practices. This will weaken your life. This will weaken your spiritual development. This will weaken your nation. This will weaken your whole life. Don't do that. But they ignored it. They ignored his warnings. They ignored his loving attempts to bring them back to a better life. Verse 11, so the Lord sent the commanders of the Assyrian armies, and they took Manasseh prisoner. They put a ring through his nose, bound him in bronze chains, and led him away to Babylon. This is a pretty big deal. The ring through the nose thing was it's always a picture of slavery. It was a sign of, you know, of being a slave in a lowly estate. And they took the king who was reigning over his kingdom. He's the king of Jerusalem, and the walls are broken down, and they come barging in the doors, and the people are like, oh, no, we're in trouble. Will our king save us? Nope, our king is captured. And they watch as the Babylonians take and put a ring through his nose, and they lead him away, not like a king, but like a common old slave prisoner, lead him out of his own city in front of his own people into slavery and brought to Babylon. Talk about humiliating, degrading, and emasculating. He's led away in front of his whole nation as a prisoner. Well, that's okay. He got what was coming to him, didn't he? Jerk. But while in deep distress, Manasseh sought the Lord his God and sincerely humbled himself before the God of his ancestors. Can I give him some props to Manasseh here? You know how hard it is for some of us to turn to God when we're in a bad spot? Because we feel unworthy? Have you ever been there before where you said, man, I don't want to pray because I'm like, I got myself into this mess. Like, how hypocritical of me to blow God off and ignore him, and then when I'm in trouble, call to him. I don't want to pray. I made my bed. I've got a lie in it, right? That's the devil in your ear, man. That's the bad advice. That's your own insecurity talking. That's not God's voice. God tells us to draw near to him, and he'll draw near to us. And Manasseh, he's been on a very bad, he has had no use, but now he's all of a sudden saying, God, it's me. Yeah, that guy. Yeah, I know I did all this and I did that and I did all those other things. We won't read. Let's not hash over the past, Lord, you know. But yeah, it's me. And he humbles himself and turns to God, which many never do. And God would be like me, perhaps, or maybe be like you. He'd be like, well, that's too bad. Is someone calling? Because I don't hear you. Should have listened to all those other times I tried to get your attention. Too late now. But that's not how God responds. In verse 13, it says, and when Manasseh prayed, the Lord listened to him and was moved by his request. That reminds me of old Hezekiah, his father, on his deathbed. It says when Hezekiah prayed, God heard his prayer and saw his tears. And now it says about Manasseh that the Lord listened to him and was moved by his request. But there's a difference between these two men, isn't there? When Hezekiah prayed on his bed, he had been an amazing, awesome, righteous, good king. Of course, God heard his prayer and saw his tears. But when Manasseh's praying, I mean, come on now, it's Manasseh. Did you read the last few verses? He'd been a terrible leader for all these years. He's done bad stuff. And yet God heard his prayer the same way. And here's why. And this is the thing I want you to hear from this part of the story. God doesn't hear my prayer, your prayer, because you're wonderful and you're worthy. He hears it because he is wonderful and worthy, because he loves you no matter what. And when you're doing well, he loves you. When you're doing pretty poorly, he loves you. When you're making great life choices, he loves you and is cheering for you and is proud of you, like we are for those who are doing well in life. And when you're making a mess of things in your life, and we all have at some spot, and he comes along and he loves you and he's hoping you'll turn it around, and he hurts for you, but God loves you all the time, and your prayers matter to him, not because of you, but because he loves you, because he values you. And Manasseh found the same God heard his prayer that Hezekiah did in his glory days, even though he was praying from a prison in Babylon. And I don't know if he was made a eunuch or not here. I have no idea, because, you know, it's the prophecy. But he's had a pretty rough stay. But he turns to God, and God heard him, heard his request. It says in the rest of the verse that the Lord brought Manasseh back to Jerusalem and to his kingdom, and then Manasseh finally realized that the Lord is alone as God. So he has a whole come to Jesus moment, right? He has this whole wow moment of his life. And I want you to think about this. First of all, the throne. Who was on the throne while he was gone? How long was that? Anyhow, we don't even know how long that was exactly. Did they have an interim king? Vice king? I don't know. Someone was running the country. He shows back up and he's like, I'm back, guys. Awkward departure. Been a rough stay, but I'm back. And they gave him the throne back. But this time, he's a new man. And here's what I want you to notice. Unlike his father before him, Manasseh will respond appropriately to the kindness that's shown him. It says in without reading the next few verses, it says that Manasseh would rebuild the walls of the city. I keep getting the wrong names here. Manasseh would rebuild the walls of the city and re-strengthen that. He would send military. He'd raise up the military to guard the cities of Jerusalem and Judah all over the country. And not only that, but in verse 15, Manasseh also removed the foreign gods and the idol from the Lord's temple. He tore down all the altars that he had built on the hill where the temple stood, and all the altars that were in Jerusalem. He dumped them outside the city. In other words, here's what he does. He comes back home and says, that's the old me. All the things that were a part of my life before that were pulling me down a bad direction, all the junk in my life that I'm ashamed of now, that was part of who I was but not who I am anymore, it's gone. He takes it all outside and he dumps it out the city and says, it's behind me now. It's a new day. I'm a new man, and I'm starting over. He then restored the altar of the Lord and sacrificed peace offerings and thanksgiving offerings on it. He also encouraged the people of Judah to worship the Lord, the God of Israel. These are the same people that he used to do the bad stuff with. He's like, hey, guys, yeah, I'm back, but I'm different. Yeah, I found the Lord. You should check it out over here. It's pretty good on the other side. Right? There's an old song called The Other Side. You wonder where I've gone, or I'm now where I belong, I'm on the other side. True, I used to walk your shore, but I'm not there anymore. I'm on the other side. Come on, guys, find the Lord with me. He calls the people to do so. However, the people still sacrificed at the pagan shrines, though only to the Lord their God. They kept the shrines that were used for other forms of worship. They said, well, you know, we're going to keep these, but worship God on them because the temple's way over there. These are closer. That's a whole other conversation that we won't get into today. But verse 18 says, the rest of the events of Manasseh's reign, his prayer to God, and the words the seers spoke to him are in the name of the Lord, the God of Israel, are recorded in the book of the kings of Israel. And in verse 19, Manasseh's prayer, the account of the way God answered him, and an account of all his sins and unfaithfulness are recorded in the record of the seers. Why did we just read that? Here's why. If anyone here is nerdy and curious enough to say, I'm wondering what Manasseh prayed. Like, he prayed this prayer from the dungeon or whatever he was in Babylon, in bad shape in Babylon, as a deposed king, humiliated and conquered. He prayed a prayer and God heard him and was moved and brought him back. What did he pray? Well, if you're curious about that, the cool thing is, it's recorded, not in our scriptures today, But in another ancient document, I've told you before that a lot of the books that are put into the Bible, the books that are put into the Old and New Testament sections, there were other books as well that throughout history, different times, different books made the collection. And were, you know, there's always a debate about what should be in the canon and what should not be up until a few hundred years ago. And we've not grown up with those debates, but they've been long time conversations. And one of the many books, the extra book, so to speak, that is on record is the Prayer of Manasseh. You can read it for yourself. It's online because it's been saved like everything else. I read it this week. I've read it before a few times. And Manasseh prayed a prayer, and he says, Lord, you know, save me. And he turns to God in his bad condition. So you can read that for yourself. But we're going to stop our story there for today. And I'm going to tell you where we're going to go next week, and then I'll wrap this up in a few minutes. Next week, we're going to go deeper into the southern kingdom, and in just a couple weeks here, the end of the southern kingdom arrives. Just a few generations to go. We'll cover those quickly, and then we're at the end. And pretty much, we're not far from the end of the Old Testament study for ourselves, because it's mostly a historical series. So we'll get to that. We'll see some of the prophets that were alive during this time, some cool stories during the captivity years, and after the captivity years, they'll return to Jerusalem someday down the road. But we got a few generations to go before this Thrones series will come to an abrupt end. Before we get there the next 2 weeks, let me just take today and just say a couple things to you that I hope you'll think about with this story today. First is this. The best stories are about those who finish well. Isn't that true? The best stories are about those who finish well. The best anything is about the... Isn't it true that the ending is so important to make the story good? You ever read a book or watched a movie that was really... Or a TV series that was really, really good and then had a terrible ending and just ruined the whole thing? I'm thinking of the TV series Lost or something like that. I don't know. Or what I'm not throwing stones here. But, you know, you ever watch... It's such a good story and then the ending just ruins it, man. What did you do? Or have you ever watched or read a story or watched a show that was like frustrating at times and just the chaos pulled you in and it was, oh, and then it resolves so beautifully, like, wow, that was a good story in the end, right? Jackie gets me. She's like, I'm with you there. So here's the thing. That's how stories are. That's how biographies work. People's lives who, you read their stories and they were awesome, but then they kind of took a dark turn and puts a kind of a dark cloud over their story. Or people who've done terrible, terrible stories, but at some point they hit rock bottom and they humble themselves, they turn things around and they finish well. The best stories are about those that finish well. In our story today, let's be real, Hezekiah was largely an awesome king. In the history books, Hezekiah did some important stuff for us to this day. His kingdom was pretty epic. He was a reformer. But because of the way he finished, it kind of put a cloud over his biography. On the flip side of the coin, Manasseh was terrible for most of his reign. Terrible. But then he hit rock bottom. He turned it around. He found his faith. And he finished well. And we find ourselves saying, yay. I'm excited. I like the ending of that story. Now, is it worth it? Is it a lesson to say, hey, mess around and just come back, finish well later? Well, no, because we don't know when we'll finish, for one. And for two, ask Manasseh or anybody how much it's not worth it to go down a stupid path of life and, you know, win the stupid prizes that we win. And I've won many of them myself, and so have you, probably. It's not worth it. But here's the lesson that I want you to take home with you. Here's the statement. I want you to remember this one. I'm about to give it to you. Just take it with you. Think about it. This week, next year, whenever you need it most, and that is this. No matter where you find yourself, determine that you'll finish well. No matter where you find yourself today, determine that you'll finish well. Now, that might be an admonition to some of us, and that might be an encouragement to some of us. If you're doing well so far, you're like, man, I'm doing well. I'm on a good path. I'm making good decisions. I'm investing in my well-being, physically, spiritually, mentally. I'm making good choices. Life is bringing me the benefits of that. And yeah, I'm doing pretty well. Great. But how many stories of people get to a spot where they stop? They stop trying. They decide to try if the grass is greener on a different side of a fence, or they just throw it away, or they get proud, or they get complacent. I don't know what happens to us, but there's so many stories like that in the scriptures and in life. So I want to say this, if you're doing well today, that's awesome. But don't just start well, finish well. Determine that you'll finish well. Stay the course. Live a life that your story will be a good one in the end. And maybe you're here today and saying, Arlen, I did not start well. Or maybe I started well and then I went wee off the edge of the ravine, you know. I mean, it's not good, okay? Here's the thing. Wherever you are, determine that you'll finish well. Come to like Manassas. Come to a spot where you say, I can't change what's happened. I wish I could. It wasn't worth it. Hey, it wasn't worth it. But it's a new day. Every page of the book is still unwritten. It's a fresh script. It's a fresh pages to be written on from here on out. I can begin again. I can start a new story from here on out. No matter where you find yourself, determine that you'll finish well. And my prayer for you, no matter what age or stage of life you are in, as your friend and as a pastor, my prayer for you is that we will all finish well.